Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
And each night we'll bring you the best, the brightest, and the authors and experts to bring the solutions that you need to hear, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's get together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now, on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet. Not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Oscar Rito back with us. She's the New York Times bestselling author of Your Best Body and her The Eat Clean Diet book franchise sold millions of copies worldwide. Tosca's life was like many others. She was miserable being overweight and out of shape and living the unfulfilled life. Now, in her early 40s, she decided that enough was enough and discovered a new way of eating clean and exercising, transformed her attitude, her health, and like she never thought possible, creating a whole new career as a fitness cover model and a best-selling author. We have in front of us The Eat Clean Diet Strip. Peel off those last 10 pounds, your ultimate dream body in 28 days. Learn the tricks of top fitness models and take it to the next level. Hey, Tosca, welcome back.
Hey, it's so great to be here again. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you for being here. Is the Eat Clean Diet Strip, is that brand new?
The Eat Clean Diet Strip is brand new, and it's doing amazingly because, I don't know, but every person I talk to seems to always have 10 pounds to lose. So I thought, here's the book that's going to do it for everyone. Let's lose those 10 pounds together.
You know, if you think about it, and I hadn't thought about it, there's a tremendous amount of people who are overweight. There's no question. There's a lot of obesity going on. But it is that 10 pounds, that just that extra few pounds that people are going to not go out and go on these diets and this and that and whatever, and they have the problem doing it. Now, the 10 pounds, the ultimate dream body in 28 days. What do you do to create that?
Well, I start by, you have to do a little house cleaning, a little housekeeping, and that is identify where in your diet sugar lives. And when I say sugar, I don't just mean table sugar or additional sugar that you pour into your coffee or your tea. There are foods that act like sugar in your body. Not only is it white table sugar, syrupy products, high fructose corn syrup, fruit juices do this, white flour products, refined flour products, pasta, bread, cereals, crackers, all of this stuff basically goes to liquid sugar. So I start just by having a little identity challenge here and have a look at what you're actually eating. And then I often get people who say to me, oh, you know, Tosca, I eat clean. I definitely know how to do that. And then I look at what they're eating, and it turns out, maybe not so much.
I got a question. You mentioned fruit juice. I've been drinking a lot of cranberry juice with some grape in it. Is that, would you consider that fruit juice?
A cranberry juice is a fruit juice. Yeah, cranberry and grape mixed together. Here's the thing. You know, when we sit down and we talk about drinking a glass of orange juice, what you can expect to find in your orange juice is at least the juice of, say, 3 full oranges. Now, that's a lot for anyone to try and eat at a given time, right? That is, it's just way, way, way too much sugar, especially if you don't have the pulp in there. It's just not something that the pancreas or the stomach can handle. So this is a place where you kind of have to identify what's going on. The other interesting thing about all that fruit juice, including your cranberry and grape, is that it's a diuretic. It acts like a diuretic. And we are also in North America chronically dehydrated. So I teach a lot of ways to incorporate drinking water into your new eating regimen. And that, too, helps to flush all this nonsense out of the body and helps you lose those few pounds.
You know, which is interesting. The thanks. Now I'm going to throw the cranberry juice out the window.
No. Just cut it with water.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Just like a half a glass of this juice that you're drinking, and the other half make it water. And that makes it friendly for your diet, for your pancreas, for your stomach, and for your waistline.
Now, we keep hearing about water. How critical is water?
Listen, we can go for 3-4 weeks without eating food. We can't even manage 2 or 3 days without water. You are in critical trouble when you don't have enough water in the body. Water is the solvent that carries nutrients to every cell in your body. It's also the ideal liquid to remove toxins from your body. It moisturizes our oxygen. It makes our brain work properly. It makes the digestive system. I mean, we eat about 6 liters of food a day. The digestive system needs to throw a good 10 liters of water at it for it to work properly. And many of us just aren't getting enough of that.
Isn't that
fascinating?
Yes. As a matter of fact, it is. And the one thing that I have not been doing is I get a lot of liquids, but I really haven't drank water. I don't know why that's so hard for people to get the water down.
I think part of the problem is that water just isn't interesting to people. And also, it's kind of interesting to note that water, for most people, doesn't really have a good taste, especially if you're used to drinking the fruit juices and so on. But I have a couple of tips for you on how to make your water more palatable. In fact, I call it making your water wetter. if that sounds crazy, but it's true. And so what you can do is get a good source of water, pour it into a glass, a little pinch of sea salt for some electrolyte balance, and a squirt of lemon juice, delicious. And you can even throw in a bit of coconut water. And this is a beautiful beverage. You've got tons of electrolytes in there, something that regular water, depending on the source, may not. And you will actually find some people tell me, you know, I drink all this water, I'm still thirsty. What's going on? And the truth is the electrolytes are missing, and the electrolytes are what make water stick. So a little extra water in the body, a little pinch of sea salt, a little coconut water, a little lemon juice, perfect cocktail. I drank it all day today.
Now, by the way, with water, with watching, I'm not even going to say diet, but nutrition, watching what you take in, et cetera, exercise is still critical, isn't it?
Well, exercise is critical because, you know, there's so many benefits to training. Not only is it a question of losing weight and getting yourself in better shape, I mean, you know, you're getting your muscles conditioned and your heart and lung conditioned, but it's also looking after the long-term health of your body. The studies come out, I think, regularly, and particularly today I heard again, that when you exercise, there's this amazing release of adrenaline, serotonin, feel-good chemicals in the brain that just make you feel better about yourself and more able to take on the world. So I take that as a big, you know, bring it on. Genetically, it's important to also train because there's something in the body called telomeres, which when we exercise, we lengthen our telomeres. This is new language here. And when we lengthen the telomeres, our lifespan is increased. Isn't that fascinating?
Sure.
So
what we're really, really talking about, when you get out of bed in the morning, it's not being accidental, it's being intentional. Most people live their lives accidentally. If something good happens, it's an accident. Something bad happens, it's still an accident. But wouldn't it be interesting if you got out of bed in the morning and were intentional of what you were going to eat, where you were going to go, how you were going to feel. And I think those things are, it's called being mindful, really. Most people just let it go. We're in a hurry to go nowhere, and we just lose a lot of it.
Well, it's very true that if you want to accomplish something, the way to do it is to attach emotion to the effort, and then it becomes a reality. If it's just, you know, oh, well, you know, I never thought about it, or, oh, maybe I'll do it, it never becomes a reality, and things will never change. It'll just be the same old that you're undertaking in your life. But in the Eat Clean Diet Strict, we prove so many things, so many tips. For example, did you know, just writing down your intention of working out and then logging your efforts makes you 50% more likely to be successful in losing that weight.
By the way, it gets a lot of frustrations out, too. I was in the gym, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, and there was this young woman sitting there with, she was doing something, I forgot what was she doing, but she was on one of the machines, and she was kind of doing it like, you know, get it over with, I'm going to do this and whatever.
Yeah.
And I walked up to her, and I said, do you want a tip? She said, what? I said, get mad at it. She looked at me, I said, no, get mad at it. You got somebody bothering you, something bothering you in your life? And she looked at me, I said, take it out of the machine. That woman had the best workout she ever had.
This is it. This is what I mean about attaching the passion. Find that thing. Say, gosh darn it, I am sick and tired of being sick and tired, or I am sick and tired of carrying those 10 pounds around, or I am fed up with not being able to fit my favorite jeans. And then, you know, get mad, get even. The weights don't talk back, but they push back, and they create shape and health like nothing else. It's not punishment. It's a pure joy.
Oh, tell me. No, I love every second of it, but it's a mind shift. Tosca, really, when you come down to it, it's redefining what your life is like, redefining exercise, redefining diet, and all of a sudden, if it takes on a different meaning, it's very easy to take in and grasp.
It is. It's wanting to. It's getting to that point. You know, Oprah calls it the aha moment, but it's getting to that point where you're just fed up and you want that change more than you want the cookie.
Did I ever tell you about Barney the beat-up bag?
I want to hear about this. No,
I've got a boxer's heavy bag. You know what those are? The heavy bag of boxers.
Yeah.
I've got one down here in the basement, and whenever I really get upset, I come down and Barney gets it, and it's good because that's what Barney's made of. He loves getting hit, and I get my stuff out. So I really believe. If people can eliminate going to the doctor, taking antidepressant pills and doing all that stuff, just go get a Barney and beat them up.
Oh, I love that idea. I've heard that too. You know, a safe way to get your anger out is always fantastic, or your frustrations. I do that with my pillow. If I'm upset about something, I just go beat up my pillow.
Yeah, there you go. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I think realistically, it comes down to it, there are so many people that you can't express, so what do? You grab a pillow, you put the pillow over your face, and you scream as loud as you can scream. But you know what happens? You don't have to say it. It's out of your system.
This is a great conversation. I'm sure there's people right now reaching for pillows going, ah!
And I wonder how many orders have we got for Barney the beat-up bags. Now, by the way, where can we buy the book at? The Eat Clean Diet Stripped.
You can find the books online at toscareno.com, or you can go to any of the better bookstores, Amazon.com. They're everywhere. And, you know, we have a New York Times bestseller on our hands, so this is wonderful. And I thank everyone for being so supportive with this. You know, it's not a diet. It's a lifestyle.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and really, it's all about how you see it, how you look at it, and your end result is what you really want out of it, because if you don't want to feel good, you're going to do everything you possibly can not to feel good, and it may not be conscious, but guess what? We control all of it.
Everything, right from eating the bad food to the good food. So really, you know, the choice is just as simple. It's knowing how, I find, is the biggest problem for most people, knowing how. So I find the comment I've heard most about any of the Eat Clean books, and the Stripped one particularly, is so easy to read, so easy to follow. This is the book I needed long ago. It's like, you know, the grade one book on how to get myself eating healthy again.
No question about it. The dog even said, yes, he's over there crying. He says, feed me. Tosca, thank you so much. And again, one more time, please, with your website.
Yes, it's toscareno.com. Come visit me.
Wonderful. Okay, we're going to see you soon. We're going to have you come back on the show.
Thank you. You are just a gem. Thank you so much.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
I wonder if our guest is appearing out of the blue. Oh, go ahead and play one then. Thank you.
BBS Radio.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true, and cling very close to each other tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
To have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lover.
It's time for the weekly tips from the publishing guru, Todd Rutherford, back with us, founder of AskThePublishingGuru.com. And as a consultant, he's been involved with the writing, publishing, and marketing of more than 2,500 different books and counting. Todd, hey, welcome back.
Good to be here, Michael.
How are you?
I'm doing great, actually. Hopefully I shouldn't cough as much this week as I have been recently. I'm on some stronger medication to try to control my asthma.
Oh, I got to tell you, there must be asthma or something around here, because I woke up this morning. Finally, it's starting to get warmer, but it's humid, and the allergies are out there. So we can spend we can spend 20 minutes sneezing.
Easily, yeah.
Okay, let's get to the real stuff that everybody's waiting to hear. Web, social media presence. Now, how much of that should an author actually have?
Well, you know, it's something I deal with on a daily basis as I'm consulting with 5 to 6 new authors a day. The question that I always receive is, do I really need a website as an author? And, what about Facebook? What about Twitter? That type of thing. And you know, I tell authors, regardless of whether you are pursuing self-publishing path or the traditional publishing path, your web presence and social media presence is the most important part of the foundation that you have to lay as an author. If you want to pursue a career as an author, you must have a congruent and well-developed web and social media presence, because that's your platform, especially in the new society and new technology and the way everything's moving towards digital, connecting with people and developing a following, developing a network of people that you are influencing. It not only helps you to promote the book that you currently have that you're promoting, but it also works to develop your monetary value in the marketplace for major publishers and things like that in the future, for your second book, your third book, and so on and so forth, because you have a built-in market. But if you don't have a strong, established web and social media presence, then you're not developing anything that's actually going to make any, long-term significant impact.
Now, by the way, Todd, what I love about what you do, and I've been around authors for many, many years now, and when someone decides to become an author, they don't realize what they're getting into. Not only do you have to be an author, you have to be a marketer, you have to be a presenter, you have to be a networker. And then when you consult with somebody, they get an idea of everything that they have to do and the direction that they have to go. I have talked to so many authors over the years that, okay, I wrote a book, now what? And they don't realize that once the book is done, that's the beginning. It's not sitting down and putting it to pen.
That's true. And the regardless, once again, of whether you pursue the traditional or self-publishing path, you're developing your web presence and your social media presence is not something that the publisher is going to do for you. So you're either going to need to do it yourself or hire a professional to do it. And, but just developing a website that looks halfway decent, whether you try to do it yourself or have a professional do it, and setting up a Twitter page and a Facebook page and a YouTube page, for instance, which are the bare minimums that I recommend, just setting them up, and even if you set them all up properly, you have them all look, good, where they all have the same similar design and connection, flow, and feel, that's still not going to, make anything actually happen. You have to, once you have everything established, you have to then, the crowds of would-be internet browsers will only learn about your site and your social media presence if you begin to promote it. And so, understanding how to get it all set up properly and how to promote it is definitely important. And it's fundamental. You don't have a chance of pursuing a successful career as an author without having it done properly.
Okay, let's go to some specifics. Facebook, effectively. How does an author use Facebook to connect?
Well, Facebook is really powerful as a part of the process, and I'll throw out one number that kind of paints the picture. There are currently 500 million people using Facebook on a daily basis. And so it's definitely the largest and one of the most powerful social media platforms for developing connections. A lot of people think of Facebook and they think, oh, that's, that's where you can connect with your friends and family and people that you went to school with from years ago and so on and so forth. But what's powerful about Facebook and what a lot of people don't realize is that it's one of the easiest platforms to be able to search for your audience. You can log into your Facebook account and just in the site's top little search bar, put in the phrase, say, cooking, for instance. And it's going to pull up several different results. And what you're looking for is any results that say group or page, because those are actual groups that have been formed of people that are excited about cooking, and even fan pages of people that are involved in certain types of cooking or interested in certain information related to cooking. In fact, if you take a look at just the group cooking the area of cooking interest portion of cooking on Facebook, 5.7 million people have actually indicated that they are interested in cooking. So if you have a cookbook, you got 5.7 million potential customers that I can teach you, or you can learn if you start studying, because we obviously don't have enough time to cover it today, but you can learn very easily how to connect with those people. And you won't be able to connect with all 5.7 million at one time, but you can begin connecting directly with people who you are certain have an interest in cooking. And you pick the topic. You can do it with any topic, whether it's business networking or whether it's parenting or romance novels or fantasy novels, or there's so many different groups and categories of interest and fan pages that you can find and connect with people that are going to be very, you know, pre-inclined based on what information you are able to find on Facebook to be someone that might buy your book, and you can begin to connect with them. That's what's powerful.
Now, by the way, that's Facebook. Now, do you have the same audience on Twitter, or is it a different audience and a different tack to take?
It's a different audience. There are some people that use both Facebook and Twitter, but for the most part, people who started on Facebook as their first social media platform have a tendency to use that as their primary social media platform, and that's how they prefer to interact. That's where they go to first. Twitter, however, there are 150 million users on Twitter, and it's the fastest growing social media platform in the world. And there are the people who use Twitter have a tendency to be people who don't use Facebook as often. So it really, you're maybe 80% of the people on Twitter don't use Facebook, and 80% of the people on Facebook don't use Twitter. You have, you know, you're getting some crossover. So it's definitely worthwhile developing a platform on both. But what's powerful about Twitter, see, the default setting on Facebook, when you set up a new Facebook account, the default setting is for your information and your conversations to be protected. So people can't see your conversations. They can only see them if they request to be your friend and you grant them permission to be your friend. Then they can see your conversations. So it's more difficult to find out to find people who are actually talking about what you do, what you've written about, what your novel is about, you know, what kind of genre that you write in, those types of things. But you can still use it by doing the searching for the different groups and fan pages that are related to your topic. So it's still possible, but a little bit more difficult. With Twitter, it is the easiest platform for finding people who are actually talking about your subject or your genre, because the default setting for a Twitter account is for your conversation to be accessible by anybody. So unless you specifically tell Twitter when you're setting up your account that you want your conversations to be protected, then they're public. And so, you know, that's obviously sitting on a whole other level. That can be both good and bad, because you need to be careful what you tweet. Don't tweet like if you're a real attractive single lady, you wouldn't want to constantly be tweeting your location. Or, hey, I'm here on the corner of 11th and Main at this Quick Trip. Having a stalker use that to harm you. But from a marketing perspective of trying to connect with people as an author that are talking about your subject, they actually, and this is completely organic. That's what's powerful. It's not something created. Twitter just kind of evolved into this, where a lot of people thought, well, Twitter's just, you know, a bunch of teenage kids, you know, just talking about silly, stupid things like, hey, I'm at the store with my buddies or whatever, or I'm at the mall or I'm at the movies. But what Twitter's become referred to and as a very powerful tool is, it is a conversation. It has become a way for two things: a dissemination of information, where, like, if I find an article, for instance, if you follow at the Publishing Guru, which is my Twitter alias, when I find articles and magazines and clips on the internet and fascinating stories that are helpful, that would be helpful to a writer having to do with a writing, publisher, or marketing books, then I send out a tweet with a little headline and a link to that article. So if you follow me, you're actually going to have access to 15 to 20 new articles and web posts and blog posts a day that are going to be helpful for you as a writer, or someone involved in the publishing or book marketing process. And that's one of the powerful things about Twitter. But also, what happens is people start conversations and they use something called a hashtag. And basically all that is the pound sign and then whatever the subject is. And so when someone's talking about, for instance, cookbooks, if people are talking about cookbooks, they'll have a tendency to put pound cookbooks in their tweet so that anybody else that wants to join in on the conversation that they're having about cookbooks or about nonprofits or about vampire novels or whatever the case might be, or about even a certain, you know, movie star, you can right now go to Twitter and you go to search.twitter.com. And if you put in the pound sign and then cookbooks all together with no spacing, it'll pull up hundreds and hundreds and even thousands of people that right now or within the last 30 minutes are actually in a conversation with them, with a group of people or two or three people talking about cookbooks. So if you're a cookbook author, this is a powerful way to connect once again directly with people who are most likely going to be interested in buying your book. And what you can do you can follow them. That's how you do it on Twitter. On Facebook, you would actually ask somebody to be your friend who's like part of a cookbook.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. H.D. Nari with us. He's the author of The Fund, a novel about the threat of financial terrorism. An international investment banker, he's focused his career on global emerging markets during his 20 plus years of experience, including his position as the managing director and principal at J.P. Morgan Chase in New York. He's advised governments, companies, and banks in countries around the world on debt restructuring, infrastructure projects, M&A, private equity, debt trading, and syndicated financing. And he's also the author of various published financial articles. H.T., hi, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
Oh, I am good, and thank you so much for being here. You know, very interesting, just in the title itself, The Fund, a novel about the threat of financial terrorism. Most people, when they hear the word terrorism, they think about somebody getting shot, somebody getting blown up, and any number of things. But I wonder how many people actually think about the threat of financial terrorism. So let's start at the beginning and let's lay a base. How can we be attacked financially?
Well, I think that, now that we have Osama bin Laden dead, and there's a lot of people sitting at Gitmo, people look at terrorists and they say, well, those, you know, swashbuckler types have been apprehended or dead. And so now their concern is, in government security circles, is those guys that are sitting there with their gray suits, people that we don't know who they are and they're hidden. And obviously they don't have names like Osama bin Laden, and we don't know where they will strike. Now, I'm a banker. And so in looking around at what's happened in the world the last 3 or 4 or 5 years,
yeah,
I think we can all agree there's been a lot of debacle that's occurred in our economy and our financial markets. A lot of it prompted by people making decisions just in pursuit of profit. Legitimate players in the market going out there, I need to make money, I need to make returns to my institution for myself, get a nice big bonus. And in the process, you know, they've taken down companies and large financial institutions have gone bankrupt. And so I looked at this and I said, well, that's interesting. You know, people in these, you know, dark pools of capital, hedge funds that are not as regulated as banks are, using instruments like derivatives that are not as regulated as other, like insurances, can do this. Why couldn't somebody who had ulterior motives, political motives, terrorist motives, do the same? with the right amount of capital, they could walk in and start taking some of these strategies. They're not looking for profit. They're actually looking to terrorize us, to damage our economy, to damage our financial markets, to freeze them up completely and damage the position of the United States around the world. So that's the premise of my book.
Yeah, by the way, H.T., when we take a look at it, we go back to 9/11. 9/11 wasn't a hit, it wasn't an attack on America only. It was an attack on the global economy. Look who was housed in those buildings.
Right. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. So when, okay.
Absolutely.
So when,
but unfortunately, I guess for us, that the groups that attacked us in that case, that attacked 9/11, they look at us as being the enemy, unfortunately. We're the ones that are not being friended on Facebook by them. So there's still a lot of attention drawn on us. I'm not saying that it's justified by any measure.
Sure, no.
The global economy and a lot of people involved. It's just, unfortunately, we're the lightning rod, and that's what we're dealing with.
No, realistically, when we take a look at the economy now, and I don't want to get political, left, right, indifferent. That's not where I'm at with this. But if we look at what's going on right now, we had an economy, and it seems as though our financial institutions, our economy, the way we have run it through the free market for so many years is withering away. And it looks like it's going to get down to that point whereby it's going to fail. And when it fails, it looks like somebody's going to inject another style of economy in. I don't know what we can do today to fix what's broken, because if we're not being attacked financially, I don't know what we're doing.
I think you bring up a very important point, and it's something that all Americans need to focus on. And I think that in my book, The Fund, you know, I had a choice as somebody with an economic background, financial background, is to kind of write a poem that had a lot of nice charts and probably 10 people read it. And so I decided to do it in the novel form and bring up some of these issues. And one of those issues is a lot of aspects of our economy, of our financial markets, are not well regulated. They're not regulated enough to avoid some of these dangers occurring, either from people who are just wanting to make a buck and or somebody who has an ulterior motive to say, I want to damage this economy. And so that is one of those issues, and that's an area right now. It's so current. It's like, you know, happening right now as we speak on the Hill, people in Congress discussing with, you know, lobbying firms and the like, how to control some aspects of these markets that come up in my book a great deal in terms of being kind of, you know, as Warren Buffett said, weapons of mass destruction, these derivatives. And so there's a discussion right now of how to better control them and have regulation around them so that we don't have these dangerous things that occurred in the likes of AIG and Lehman and others again. So your point is well taken, and there are things right now that the country needs to be addressing, and we'll see what happens by the end of the summer if those do get addressed or not.
You know, an interesting point, when we take a look at this, if we say a regulatory agency, which I think would be a phenomenal idea, but it has to be outside the government. Look at the pharmaceutical industry for a great example. Everything's been tested. Tested by whom? Not the government, not an outside agency, but the pharmaceutical industry. So in essence, if government controls it, if the government is the regulatory body, then you really have nobody watching it, because what goes on is what they want to go on.
Right. No, I think what you need is someone watching over that, A, understands what they're watching, because that has not been the case, and B, is somebody that can be trusted, and that's a big issue. And you know what? And here's the thing: I'm not suggesting that we need to control this stuff so that it leaves us, because, you know, frankly, this is stuff that, you know, the Pandora's box has been opened. This kind of business is profitable for banks. It's a trading business, and they make a lot of money off of it. And frankly, if we control it too much of the country, it will go to another country where they don't regulate it as much, and it'll still happen, because if people are looking for profit, it'll, you know, the money will go towards a higher yield, and it'll happen. So we have to strike a balance between keeping it not from being, you know, fatally dangerous to a place where people can make money, and that we can continue to be a country where we have high-end technology in terms of our financial industry.
Sure. I think what's happening right now is we're going through a process of destabilization. Each time we think we've got an answer to something, there's another package of money that goes out to another country somewhere to do something with. And what's going on? Where do we, well, I won't say what's going on. Where do we get the money to loan somebody money to do whatever the case may be? We have to borrow it for someone else. So if we look at some of these things that I really believe, HT, when it comes down to it, none of this can be accidental. This has to be intentional. And because it has to be intentional, and I'm not coming from a conspiracy theorist point of view, coming from a pragmatist point of view. And if it is intentional, that we need to know what the end result is. And I think there's where the confusion is right now. The economy, the direction of the economy is a trickle-down effect, but it doesn't have to be trickle-down. It could be trickle-up if we have the control over the elected officials. And I think that's where the problem is. Now, to the book. I pick the book up. I read it page by page, cover to cover. I really get into it. What's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, get at the end of that book that I didn't have before I started reading?
Well, first of all, I hope that you got lost in it. I tried to make sure that it had some interesting characters in there. That's number one. Number two, you will, without having to study or take a quiz, you'll probably have picked up a thing or two about financial markets and how they operate, not only in our country, but globally. And finally, you'll probably think about some of the broader issues that impact our country right now and our position in the world. Things like, for example, the strength of our currency and what's the likelihood of it being the global reserve currency and what that means to us as a country, what it means to us in terms of our economic power and what our economic power does for us in terms of our presence in the world and in different countries and security issues that occur in different countries. I think that's the kind of stuff you'll walk away with. And finally, I think what most people walk away with when they read the book and they say to me, they go, in a kind of in a hushed tone, they go, and they look at me kind of serious, they go, can that really happen? That's what they ask. And my answer to them has always been, we have very unrestricted markets, that this has happened, some aspects of this have happened before, and so there is a potential of happening. But the stronger response from me is that about a month ago, I ran across an article that talked about some report that had been commissioned by the Department of Defense, and they were looking at something called economic warfare. I looked at that, I found through my sources in Washington a copy of that report, I read it, and about 90% of that report comes out in terms of parallels with my book, which is a fiction novel. And that told me that here's the Department of Defense commissioning somebody to go through and analyze this as an economic warfare issue. And then my book is basically saying the same thing. I sat down with a guy that wrote it. We had a big, long discussion in front of a whole bunch of academics at Georgetown about a week ago. And I tell you, no one in the room, which was composed of academics and people from the intelligence community, were saying, can this really happen? They were actually saying, they were getting down to nitty-gritty of, like, you know, the mechanics of how this could happen, sure, how we could be attacked as a country from an economic point of view and what that means for us, you know, in the future.
But take a look at it. When you look at this, you mentioned something about economic power. I wonder if we really have any more throughout the globe. You know, we're a laughing stock in a lot of places, and there's a lot of places that have lost respect. But as a physical force, as a warring force, there's not a country on the continent, in the world, in the globe, that could stand up to us toe to toe. But you want to defeat us. What you do is you cause us to implode. You cause us to divide. You erode the economy. And everything that's going on right now is everything that someone could possibly do. And the only way to destroy us is from what's going on right now. And it's got to be happening from somewhere, and somebody's got to be behind it, and nobody really knows.
Okay. I think there's definitely possibilities of those things, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you say as a possibility. But I think critical, the timing of your book, it's critically important that people take a look at it, because if you want to be strong, if you want to protect yourself, you have to have the knowledge to do so. You have to know where to go and what moves to take to be able to accomplish a goal. HT, if you don't know, then you're stuck, and there is no strength.
Yeah, no, and I think one point that I want to be clear about is that I bring up a lot of issues in the book that I think are important for us to be talking about, and you've honed in exactly on the right areas, Michael, which is, I give you credit for that. The other side of it is, I on the balance of it is, I do think this is probably you know, this is the best country in the world in terms of people wanting to come here, sure. wanting to come here and thrive here, and the way our system is set up, that people can come in and work hard and provide excellence, provide value added, they can thrive and they can make a better life for their families and their future generations here. This is still the best place to do that in around the world. And that, at the end of the day, is our strength. The fact that we have this system that allows us to do that. And I think that is the thing at the end of the day that will save the day. However, we have to be careful in, as we're taking these steps to make sure that we're making the right steps to maintain that.
It's protecting ourselves and the right steps. Who controls the right steps? Who controls the banking industry? Who controls Wall Street? What seems to be happening right now is the government is nationalizing the banking industry. They're nationalizing the education industry. They've taken over Wall Street and so on and so forth. And the problem with that is they really don't know how to deal with what they've got. Every department head that I have seen so far does not have the expertise to deal with the department. You know, you take somebody like Petraeus, who's doing a wonderful job in Afghanistan. You're going to pull him off the job and you're going to put him someplace else. See, there's something wrong with all of this.
Well, I think you're making a full support of my book in terms of the things I come up. Because I basically say I critique the fact that people are not watching as carefully as they should. And in that process, in the story of my book, we end up in some dangerous zones in terms of, you know, weaknesses that people can take advantage of from the outside. And so, yeah, I agree with you. Not the right people are watching everything right. Now, the Petraeus thing, though, is an interesting one. In the sense that he is obviously a very capable man, the most important thing about that change that is very relevant for our world today is that the fact that you have a general, basically, the head of the CIA, which is a very different thing, and that's a very momentous thing that's occurred because that's traditionally, it's a civilian that heads up the CIA. There is obviously something else called the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is usually headed up, which is always headed up by a military person, which, by the way, is the service within my book that is, there's a character in there that finds a thread of some funny stuff going on, and she is the one that chases it down, and she is a defense intelligence officer, and that is traditionally run by the military, but not the CIA. So I thought that, when I saw that placement, I thought that was extremely momentous in the intelligence community, and I talked to people in Washington about it afterwards, and they were equally amazed by that placement, because it may create tensions within the CIA, and that's not necessarily a good thing, because we obviously need everybody focused on intelligence work.
Sure, and there, so it's the decision of who goes where and why, and that, by the way, HT, you're dealing with the same thing with money. Money has its own purpose, it has its own life, it has its own strength, and if you put it into the right place, it grows, and anything along with it, it's like it seeds things. You put it in the wrong place, it's going to step on you. And I think that's the biggest problem that we're having now. I don't think that there's any clarity about what to do. There's so many decisions to be made that I think everybody's scrambling in the administration at this stage of the game. And by the way, it doesn't really matter whether it's Republican or Democrat. I've got I happen to be right to center, but I'm watching Republicans do the same exact thing. They're scrambling, trying to find answers, And when they do that, they don't allow you to know what's going on because they're afraid to stand up and say, it's my fault. There's where the biggest problem is. And if we don't do something quick about that, if we don't look at our economy, or don't look at our banking industry, we can spend hours of what happened to the banking industry in the last couple of years,
right.
The leveraging, et cetera, et cetera. But the point of contention is nobody is paying attention to this that can do anything about it. I really got to that point where I think everybody's afraid to make a mistake of what somebody else is going to think. Every time there's a decision to be made, there's going to be a committee, and we'll have an answer to you in 2 months.
Well, in that case, and I think if your listeners are of the same vein, they're going to like my book because they're going to go in that book and they're going to be able to see how some of these things operate in the government and understand it better, which is, I think, in all of our interests for more people to understand how decisions can be made and what are some of those critical decisions that we need to be looking at. That, you know, one decision here is going to have an impact down the road on something else, and that's extremely important. So your point is well taken.
Yeah. And by the way, the book in and of itself, I think you should send a couple of copies to the White House.
Okay. That's a good point.
Yeah. Autographed, cool. Obviously.
What's that address again?
I hear you loud and clear. Loud and clear.
Well, you know what, Michael? I hate to tell you this, but in the book, there's a lot of things that are mentioned in my book that somehow trickle in later on and come true, and that's a little bit freaky. But I'll tell you one mistake that I made to my editor. That I did have the address of the White House at one point for some purpose in the storyline in the book, and I got the address wrong, so that's why I had to ask. They corrected me on the exact number on Pennsylvania Avenue that I was getting wrong.
Gotcha, loud and clear. This is why I think people should be listening to you. And I say this respectfully, and I say this from a background of years and years and years standing back and watching everything that's going on, is that if you want to know something about money, you go to an economist. If you want to know something about how money is being used, you go to an investment banker. And I really believe if some of the people that were running some of the departments in the White House had the expertise in that particular area, we wouldn't have the problems. With your knowledge and what you've seen internationally, you can forecast. And there's what people should be looking at in the book. It's the forecast. You know, this is not, it's not fantasy. It's not fiction. What you're talking about is fact, and it's projecting.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. And you're absolutely right about not having the right people on top of it. And I hate that, you know, criticize overtly, but I have to tell you, for one clear example of that, of what you just said, is if you look at our current Treasury Secretary, before this job, he was in charge of the New York Fed. Okay, he was the president of the New York Fed for, you know, a few years, and the New York Fed is a very important position within the federal banking system, in the sense that the banks are supervising are basically the global capital of finance, right, in and around Wall Street, right. And there, if you go on their website, I'm a kind of a boring guy sometimes, I look up on their website and I see a whole bunch of speeches that he gave when he was the Fed president. And they're all complaining about derivatives and, you know, we're concerned about them and how they're being managed and, gosh, what are we going to do with them, and, you know, and so on and so forth, and suggesting that things need to change. Well, guess what? Nothing happened. A lot of speeches, but nothing happened.
Sure.
Okay, we had the debacle, you know, 2008. We had a lot of problems, Lehman, Bear, and the like. There's indications of, you know, how derivatives had an impact on that and the concerns it raised, you know, with the likes of AIG. And yet nothing happened. A lot of speeches, but nothing happened. And so now that's our current Treasury Secretary.
Yeah, no, and it got it loud and clear. And it's interesting because that's happening in quote-unquote department after department. The one rule I think that we should have is that if you're involved in the International Monetary Fund, you should never be let alone in a hotel room by yourself. What do you say, right?
Yeah, that's dramatic. Okay, you know, see, this is where people say, well, you wrote a novel. But you know what? Sometimes, you know, what happens in real life can be stranger than fiction. And that's just, you know, who could have programmed that to be happening?
No, absolutely. Who would have called that in a million years? Oh, well. We're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you and the book at?
Yeah, you can find me on www.htnarea.com, or you can just look me up on Amazon and look for The Fund on Amazon, and you'll find it, and you'll eventually find the links to me.
Hey, wonderful. HC, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael Ray.
Take care. Good night.
Night.
All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking, whatever that is, Thought Provoking Talk. You can tell this is not taped. And Dresser After Dark.
Hallelujah. I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love
Yes, and if you want somebody that you a topic that you want to hear addressed, if you want a guest on the show, get a hold of Radio Susie. Go to www.dresserafterdark.com. Many, many things coming up. We've got a chat room that we're going to be creating. Well, we've created. It'll be available very shortly. And let's go to our guest, Jack Cotton, with us. He's the founder of Cotton Real Estate, now a Sotheby's International Real Estate. His primary business is the secondary home market in Cape Cod. He's one of the most successful luxury real estate agents in America, a popular speaker. Cotton is the author of 12 Secrets of Luxury Home Sellers That They Know, 12 Secrets Luxury Home Sellers Know, and Selling Luxury Homes. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Great to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. If I can get over my mouth tonight, we'll be in great shape.
I know the feeling very well.
When we talk luxury home, what actually is a luxury home?
Well, you know, that varies from market to market, but we typically say, you know, whatever homes are priced in the top 10% of your market. So in different areas, that could be a different number. My market, it's, say, $1 million and above. Another market, it might be $5 million and above. But the bottom line is it's usually the top 10% of whatever market you're in from a price standpoint.
Now, by the way, you know, in the market that we're in now, and it's a tough market for a lot of people wanting to buy a home, especially, you know, first-time home buyers, those people who have decided to buy a home. Credit is very hard to get today, but I can imagine the experience I've had over the years, if you had enough money down, I don't think credit really matters that much. But the point of contention is how in a depressed market like this, Jack, can somebody look at a luxury home? Will the value be there that they're putting money into?
Well, you know, right now is a historic moment in time in that there has never been a better time to buy real estate in any price range. And what I think is important for me to convey to your audience is the fact that while I deal with people buying million-dollar homes, what I've learned from dealing with these people over the years, over more than three decades, are great lessons that anybody can apply to any price range in any part of the country. So what I've sort of done is looked at all the people I've worked with over the years as they're buying their second and third and fourth home for, you know, $1, $5, and $10 million and above. What practices do they use when they're buying a house? What practices do they use when they're selling a house? And how can I boil this down into 12, I call them secrets, or 12 principles that the average person can use when they're buying or selling real estate? And you're right, the market now is extremely challenging, not a fun time to be a seller. On the other hand, it's the perfect time to be a buyer.
Now, by the way, if I have some of the secrets, the processes to go through, that also gives me a leg up, doesn't it? That allows me to be able to do something that most people don't do, forecast. I can look ahead to see the when, the why, the what, and where to go to buy what I want.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, forecasting is a challenge sometimes because no one's really 100% correct when they're making financial forecasts. Look at Warren Buffett. He's not a market timer, but he looks for value. He looks for compelling value. And in a market like this, compelling is the operative word. So what you want to do if you're thinking about buying real estate now, rates are probably the lowest they're going to be in a long time. And prices are down in many markets between 30 and 50% and sometimes even more. So when you're buying at the bottom of the market like this, no one can time the bottom exactly, not even Warren Buffett. But if you have a long-term horizon, which I define as minimum 5 to 8 years or longer, you can't lose in real estate. I don't care what anybody says about the real estate market. It is absolutely, hands down, the number one best investment you can ever make, and that is real estate, especially in the form of a house or a home.
You know, by the way, Jack, time and again, the real estate market has proved to be cyclical. It goes down, but it comes back up again.
It does.
Yeah, 1985, I was in Fairbanks, Alaska, and my ex and I bought some property, and we built on it. It was 10 acres up there. I think at the time it cost us something like $120,000. Well, in, what was it, 1992, 93, something like that, we sold it for about $190,000. And then the people were there. Then we had that market crash. And by the time the market crashed, they ended up selling the whole thing, losing $30,000, $40,000. So if they had held on to it, that value came back up again. But it's always up and down. But I think you're absolutely correct when it comes to real estate. If you can wait it out, your dollars are going to come back to you.
And again, see what happened, a lot of things happened to create the situation that we're in today. But a big thing that happened is that people forgot the rules of real estate, the rules that we learned from our parents and our grandparents, which is to make a down payment, to to buy a house, buy less than you can afford, and make a plan to pay it off. Your house is not an ATM. Your house is not something that you buy for 6 months to flip, you know, in 6 or 9 or 10 months. I mean, some people did do that, but it's not something you can do on a consistent, dependable basis. I mean, nobody can do it. A lot of people who are doing it, sort of the music stopped and they lost everything on the last house. So if you have a 5 to 8 year minimum horizon, now is the time to be out there buying real estate. Absolutely.
No, by the way, one of the things that I know that you talk about, because if I go back and look years back, if you bought a house and you had a 30-year mortgage, you could figure the house was going to cost you three times the whatever the asking price was by the time you got your interest and et cetera, et cetera. But
sure,
you're saying that rates are low today, but it could also be the most expensive time to borrow.
Well, you're right. When you look at the real cost of money, which is the mortgage rate minus inflation, it is expensive today, the real cost of money, which is about 3%, because if mortgage rates are averaging 5 and inflation is averaging, I'm using round numbers, averaging 2,
sure,
your real cost of money is 3%. When I started in real estate, we were excited to get a 12% mortgage back in the 1970s. And at the same time, inflation was 15%, so you had an actual negative cost of money. So what that means is you can be enticed by a low publisher rate, like 4.5% or 5%, and you tend to go out and borrow more than you need and buy more than you need. And what you have to understand is that, as you alluded to a second ago, interest compounds. It's steady, it can be insidious, and it's unrelenting. Albert Einstein said that compound interest should be the eighth wonder of the world. So if you borrow money at 5%, you're going to pay back double in 14 years. And if you borrow for 30 years, you're right, you're going to pay back triple. So the goal is to get a fixed-rate mortgage today, lock in a really low rate, buy less house than you can afford, and make a plan to pay the mortgage off early. You know, if you pay one extra payment a year, you can chop 7 years off the life of the loan just by doing one payment more a year. Or if you can't do that, do $100 more a month. There is no more secure investment that you can make today than to prepay your mortgage. Even if your mortgage is 5%, where if you had $100, where are you going to invest $100 today and earn a guaranteed 5%? There's no
sure
place. Guaranteed.
Yeah, no,
but if
absolutely
you pay off your loan, you're going to put the miracle of compound interest to work for you instead of against you.
And by the way, it's all negotiable, and I think that's where people should, you know, sit back and take a look at things. You know, an asking price, an interest rate, et cetera, is negotiable. I take it back to I bought some more property up there and we did some building on it. So I got the interim loan and everything was fine. I'm going to pick a number because it's long ago. I can't remember what the percentages were. But I'm standing on the lot and I've got, a house maybe two-thirds built. And the banker called me and he said, and I've got a cell phone. I'm standing out in the middle of nowhere. And I've got my cell phone, and he said, I got to pick a number because I can't remember. And he said, the interest rate's going to be 10%. Right at that time, my battery died, and I got disconnected. And I walked over, I put another battery in, and he called up. He said, you didn't have to get mad and hang up. We can do it at 8.
That's great.
So the battery made me some money that day.
But, well, the other thing is, you also are following another important rule, and I'll get in trouble for this one, but that is, if you're going to be buying a house, in obviously getting a mortgage, as most people do, you're going to do a lot better dealing with a local community bank than you are with some huge, faceless, nameless mortgage company. Now, if you had been on the phone with some big, giant mortgage company, you never would have gotten that two-point reduction.
No way. And it,
right,
was, you know, it was good because the bankers were friendly, and those local banks, you still, they know who you are when you walk in, and it's
they
like the old
moment.
Yeah.
They still do. They have more rules, they have more regulations, but you can still go and talk to a person. And a lot of people get enticed by these rates. And I'll see people, you know, planning to buy a house, and you'll see a rate from some mortgage company based in a state, you know, 1,000 miles away that's an eighth of a point less. By the time it gets through with all the extra closing costs and hidden fees, they're paying way more than if they had just gone to a bank that's located in the community where they're going to buy the property, who knows the area, who can give them guidance, who can negotiate if necessary, who can work with you if you get into tough times. Stick with a community bank. And I know I'm going to be alienating people in the mortgage business, but that's my advice.
No, I hear you loud and clear. And it's true. Stick to somebody where your name, you're not a number. One of the other things you talk about is so critical. Most people don't even think about this. You're talking about, you've got to be mentally prepared. Jack, you say it, you got to be mentally prepared to buy or sell, because if you're not, you could lose.
Absolutely. That's one of the characteristics of wealthy people. they prepare themselves mentally for everything they're going to do, including the purchase of real estate. They think about what they're going to buy. They make a plan for how they're going to use it. They understand what they can afford. They think more deeply. Most people spend more time planning a vacation for a week than they do planning the purchase of a house. You know, what's the mortgage rate and what's the payment going to be? Well, that's great. Well, what about maintenance? What about insurance? What about utilities? What about repairs that are going to be needed unexpectedly down the road? I mean, the wealthy home buyer thinks of all.
We think we lost the guest. We'll get him back. We'll see what happens. We're talking about buying real estate and so many of the factors that are incorporated into it that we don't think about. And especially in today's market, now is the best time to buy. There are so many houses that are sitting there for sale. And I think one of the major points that Jack brought up was be mentally prepared to be able to buy that house. Because if you're not prepared, you don't go in with a plan, quote unquote, you may not necessarily think, you may not get what you think you're going to get. One of the other things that if we get them back, we'll talk about, it's when you're selling your home. Think about it, you know, staging that home, rethink about it. When you are selling a home and you're going to design it and you're going to doll it up and so on and so forth, you could kill yourself. One of the reasons you could kill yourself, it may not be what that other person that's coming into your home to look at it to buy actually likes. Get the walls white. Make everything bland. Let them create when they come in and see it themselves. Today's buyer is a very different kind of a buyer than the buyer was 15, 20, 25 years ago. And a buyer today, there's nothing that's hidden. Everything, when it really comes down to it, it's visible. You can see right through it. Everything is transparent. You can Google anything that you want. So in buying a home, they've got to be, not that they wouldn't be, quote unquote, but they've got to be 1,000% honest with you because, oh, good. Jack, we lost you. I just became a real estate.
I'm not sure what happened there. I was talking away and then I sensed there was nobody there.
Yeah, we got the same thing. I was just talking about when you're selling to the staging, the part and the idea that the real estate agent has got to be totally honest with you because we can find out anything we want. We can Google anything. Let's talk about staging for a minute, creating, making that house look a certain way when
sure.
you're going to walk in. What I had said when we lost you for a minute is don't doll it up the way you would because that person coming in may not like the way you do things and it could talk them out of it. Should you be very bland in staging?
Well, listen, here's the thing about staging. First of all, if you look at the word staging in the dictionary, you know, some of the words, some of the synonyms that are going to come out are contrived, fake, not real, you know, pretend. And today's buyer in every price range is a very sophisticated person, very not interested in being manipulated, not interested in being played. So we really need to redefine the whole concept of staging in preparing a home for sale. So the word I like to use is sort of preparing the home to maximize market value. And the way you do that is to make your home look loved. So if you overdo the staging, you can actually turn people off and make them suspicious and wonder, gosh, is this person hiding something? For instance, I was showing a house maybe 6 weeks ago. It was, I think, like $2.5 million house. And the buyers were back for the third time. And the seller had baked an apple pie. She had birch logs burning in the fireplace. Just all kinds of stuff, over-the-top stuff was going on in this house. And the buyers came in, and they were really getting sort of suspicious about, why is the seller trying so hard? So they did buy the house, but it took a lot of work to get them over that suspicion that they had. So my advice to people when you're preparing a home for sale is to, quite simply, make your house look loved. You don't need to do a lot of crazy staging, but make everything look clean, uncluttered, clean out the closets, clean out the counters. I tell people, vacuum your pipes in the basement so that when people come in, their human nature is going to be to judge what they can't see, but what they can see. So when they go to the basement and the pipes are clean, when they go into they open the dishwasher and the little thing around the door is clean. When they walk up to your front door, do you realize today, with today's buyer, you have 18 seconds to make a first impression on a potential buyer, and you have a cracked doorbell, you have, you know, peeling paint on the door, or the windows aren't clean, or there's weeds in the garden. I mean, these are the important things to make your house look loved and cared for. Why should a buyer like your house if it looks like you don't?
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, that's true. And I think I would cut that 18 seconds down to about 6 or 7 seconds.
You
walk in.
Yeah, you're probably right. You know, we used to say you had a minute. Then we said you had 30 seconds. Now we're down to 18. You're probably right. We're probably down to 5 or 6.
Yeah. You're going to walk in and you're going to glance at it. You're going to see something. You're going to see the grass isn't cut real quick. Bang. And that
right.
could determine everything. And you cannot make a second first impression.
And everything they think about as they view your house is going to be filtered through that impression that occurred in that first 6 seconds.
Yeah, no question about it. Now, by the way, the old house hunting habits of those people who are really buying the luxury the homes, what should they look for? What should they do? What are things that normally people don't do?
Well, again, they have a plan. They know what they're looking for. They know what areas they want to be in. And they set up a network. So if you're thinking about buying a house in pick a town, pick a neighborhood, well, you want to learn everything there is to know about that town and neighborhood. You're going to talk to people, whether it's a person working at the local restaurant or the shoe store or the hardware store or the barbershop. You know, wealthy buyers get information from every source. When they get the information, they'll decide if it's useful or not or actionable or not, but they don't turn their nose up at anyone who can possibly give them information. If they go out to breakfast at the local diner, they're going to ask the server, what do you like best about living in this area? What's the best part of town to live in? I mean, they're going to be asking questions all the time. They may not, you know, use that information. They'll decide if it's important or not, but they're always, always, always collecting information. And the average home buyer can emulate that by building their own network in the area they want to purchase the property and go and talk to people who are in the trenches, so to speak, the person at the hardware store, the shoe store, the drug store, and find out what they like. And, you know, if you could change one thing about this neighborhood, what would it be? Or if there's one thing you don't like about this neighborhood, what would that be? And what's your favorite thing about this place that we live in, that you live in? And you just build intelligence. And people, it amazes me how people do more research on buying a new car than they will on buying a house. And conversely, when we talk about staging, I've seen people putting their house on the market where there's, dog dew all over the lawn and there's weeds growing and the branches are rubbing on the house and the house is a mess. And there's one particular place, they were all out in the yard detailing a 10-year-old Volvo that was probably going to sell for $2,000. Meanwhile, the house is falling down. I'm like, where's the priorities?
Yeah, no, by the way, one other thing I think is really critical, and we're starting to run out of time, but this is very important, and I know you emphasize this, work with the experts. The money you spend with an expert is going to save you money in the long run.
And that's an important lesson we've learned from the luxury home buyer and seller. You know, luxury people deal with experts in every facet of their lives, whether it's tax experts, medical experts, legal experts. They always want to deal with someone who knows what they're doing. And sadly, a lot of people think that a real estate person is a toll taker and along the path to getting a house bought or sold, and it doesn't really matter who they hire. But it's critical to make sure you're working with an expert. You need to develop a list of interview questions. And the questions are slightly different whether you're looking to buy a house or sell a house, but it's a business, and you have to treat it like that. When an agent is coming to you about listing your house, they're essentially applying for a job. If you're interviewing somebody to fill a position that you were going to hire for, what would you ask that person? Well, those are the same kinds of questions you should be asking an agent to make sure they have the expertise necessary to get your house sold.
No question. Jack Cotton, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have
sure.
a website we can find you at and the book?
Of course. I have 2 books, 12 Secrets Luxury Home Buyers Know, 12 Secrets Luxury Home Sellers Know. You go to jackcotton.com, all one word, jackcotton.com, or, of course, you can search them on amazon.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Jack, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Bye.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way, a girl to hold in my arms. I know the magic of her charms, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone. Where are you with a love oh so true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old? Because I want a girl to call my own.
I want to dream, lover, so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how, I hope that she'll hear my plea. Some way, I don't know how, she'll bring her love to me. Dream, lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do till all my lover's dreams come true. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Olivia Williams with us, the author of Poetic Island, Refreshing Expressions from Wata Kubli, and she's also the host of the Hour of Power radio show that aired in Dominica. And let us say, Olivia, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
By the way, did I pronounce that right? Was it Wata Kubli?
Wata Kubli, yes. Wata Kubli. okay, you can
say
answer
right.
a question about it.
Yeah. Okay. Now, by the way, when you say poetic expressions, poetry in and of itself is so expressive because what it does, it takes that internal something that somebody sees and you externalize it. So it's not just what you see on the outside. It comes from a very special place inside.
Yes, it does. And actually, the poetic is not just for poems because really most of my book is short stories. But the poetic part comes because when you come to this island, which is in the Eastern Caribbean, Dominica, to me it evokes an impassioned feeling that can only be expressed in imaginative words. And that's why I call it Poetic Island.
Now, by the way, I spent a year in the Caribbean, from 1982 there. I was working on cruise ships in those days, and we were, you know, from St. Thomas and all the different islands. And what a very different place it was. It was a place where it was so different from what I was used to coming, you know, stateside. And there was a lot of beauty there, and there was a few things that I will never forget. I can't remember which two oceans collide there, quote unquote, but I remember standing in St. Thomas, and on one side of the dock was one ocean, and the other side of the dock was the other, and there was actually a difference in the water temperature.
Yes, the Caribbean Sea meeting the Atlantic Ocean.
Yes, that's it, yes. Yeah, that was a long time ago, but I do remember it well, and I remember standing on top of a hill and looking out over the ocean, and it was absolutely magnificent. Quick story, and then we'll get into this, because it was something that captured me, and I would love to write a poem about it if I could write poetry. I was on the cruise ship. I was an entertainer years ago in those days, and one of the people that owned one of the shops invited the crew up for a party. Now, it wasn't a party, but it was being nice to us. He invited us up to the house, and there was food and et cetera there. The house was at the top of the hill. Now, the house was a nice house. It wasn't anything that was phenomenal, but it was a nice two-story house. They took us on a tour of the house. And, Olivia, I will never forget this as long as I live. We went to the second floor, opened the door to the bedroom, and the one wall that was facing the ocean, there was no wall there.
It was
completely
just wide open.
Yes, and I will never forget that, and I can see it right now. I will never forget that as long as I live. And the power of poetry is the ability to put that into words so somebody can see it through your words.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the book in and of itself, what was it that caused you, where was the spark that caused you to put this together?
Well, there was two sparks. The first spark was in 1999. I went on a study abroad. I had never been out of the USA. And I went to four different Caribbean islands, and when I stepped in Dominica and I was at the Trafalgar Falls and a waterfall and the fresh water was hitting me, and I remember our guide telling us, you can drink from this water. And I was laughing because I'm like, I've never imagined being in a water, a river, and then also being able to drink from it. And that is when inside of me, it was like I came alive. And I kept thinking about, how can I get back to this place? And so a few years later when I graduated from my university, I enlisted in the Peace Corps hoping that I would get the opportunity to go back to Dominica. To make a long story short, I joined the Peace Corps. There were five different islands to choose from, or not really choose from, in which they selected us from. And I basically went to the director of Dominica and told him I would be serving in Dominica. And that is where I began writing my poetic island.
Well, you know, the Peace Corps in and of itself, there's so many stories about the Peace Corps. What is it? What was it like being involved, being part of it?
Well, and it was just like I imagined. I imagined myself working in a rural community, doing community development work and working with young people, and that's just what I did. I was in a very isolated community called De Las Cies, which is about an hour and a half ride from the capital city. I had a population of about 300 people. I had a little house on a little hill, and I worked with the Department of Education providing life skills training. I worked with local organizations, helping them to develop their ecotourism product. And I just did a lot of observing in nature and observing people's simple lifestyles. And I went to town about twice a month just to pay my bills. So that was my lifestyle.
And by the way, ecotourism, you mentioned that. Define that. What is that? Is that something that has started a few years back and is starting to take hold now?
Yeah, actually, about 20 years back, ecotourism, in plain terms, is just responsible travel to natural areas that conserves the environment and improves the well-being of local people. And there are some guiding principles. First of all, you know, you want to minimize the impact. You want to build environmentally and cultural awareness. You also want to provide positive experiences for both visitors and the host of that location. You want to provide financial benefits to conservation. And also, you want to create a sensitivity to the host country's political, environmental, and social climate.
That would be an interesting thing. I remember years back when I was doing the ships, there was the plane that took us to this one cruise line, and it was at, oh, what was it? What was it? Was it the... it was when England went to war with the Dominican Republic. That's what it was. And I remember those kids, which is a very interesting, it was a very interesting experience. The kids that had been aboard the cruise ship, some were from England and some were from the Dominican Republic. And the two countries decided they were at war for, I don't know, lasted a month maybe. And it was very interesting to watch the kids who lived together, played together, were family, quote-unquote, to spent their entire lives together. Now all of a sudden they were enemies. And it was a phenomenal thing to watch the transition. And then we pulled up to the port in the Dominican Republic and those other kids got off. But what an interesting thing to see, you know, how not just the environment but external forces affect an environment that is so far away that it unless you told them, they wouldn't even know anything was going on.
And I'm glad you say the Dominican Republic, because some people, Dominica is different from the Dominican Republic.
Yeah, right.
Dominica is the English island between the French islands of Guadeloupe and Martinique. And some of my mail actually used to go to the Republic of Dominica.
Okay, no, and by the way, yes, that and the Dominican Republic is over, it's in South America, and the Caribbean, the islands are, they're over on the other side. I know you have to go by Cuba to get there. I remember that.
Yeah. And some people get the demographics really mixed up because there are almost 30 different islands in the Caribbean going all the way from up to Cuba all the way down to Grenada. And the Dominican Republic is actually connected to Haiti, and a lot of people don't know that. They think it's a separate island by itself. Haiti is connected to Dominican Republic.
Have you ever
been
there?
So you have a French-speaking side, and then you have a Spanish-speaking side, and there's a line that divides them, and there's a lot of hatred between that line. So I could definitely relate to the people getting off the ship and developing this hatred for each other.
Now, Martinique's like that, too, with the two different languages, aren't they? I think it was Martinique was like that. But have you ever been on Haiti?
You know, that's an island I haven't had the opportunity to go to yet. It seems like every time I get ready to set sail, something political happens, or as we had the devastation with the earthquake took place a few weeks before I was supposed to go, actually.
it's a scary place. And when I say a scary place, I remember we came up to it three or four times, and I remember I didn't want to get off the ship. There's this real interesting feeling around that island. So I've never been there. The rest of them, St. Thomas and the rest of them, absolutely. You know, it was one of those things.
It is a different feeling.
Yeah.
And it's a different feeling because if you go back in history in the 18th century, Haiti was the first country in the Western Hemisphere to get their independence. The slaves were. And so, and a lot of them evoked their ancestry traditions and practiced voodoo, and they were really into a different spiritual world to help them, empower them to conquer the conquerors. And so it's a lot of that tradition is the foundations of that country, and it's so different. I mean, no other country really is on that same level.
No question.
And
yeah,
I
no,
think
you...
because of that victory, they have also been, you know, devastated because of that, you know. That's a whole nother discussion, though, Michael.
That's another time and another place. No, I got you loud and clear. Okay, I pick up the book. I pick up Poetic Island, read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? Olivia, what do I get out of that book? What's for me?
Well, your takeaway is this. You are going to enjoy the simple pleasures of life. In the book, this book is written for individuals who enjoy things such as breathing clean air, drinking spring water from a river, enjoying a day by a river, or watching the sunrise, listening to birds sing, or just enjoying an upbuilding conversation with a neighbor. It's like you go back in time when you're there, because actually a lot of places there only got cable in the late 1880s. So you're talking about a people that are very isolated from the rest of the world. Almost 90% of the hotel accommodations are owned by local people, which is unlike any other island. Almost 60% of the island is dedicated to conservation, where they still maintain their pristine trees. And so what this book does, it brings out the extraordinary, because in the book, Dominica is a place where I experience the extraordinary every day. And these are my extraordinary experiences I'm relating to individuals in the hope that they will go there and experience nature at its best, which is extraordinary.
But what is it, that the essence of Dominica, what's the essence of it there? If you were to be able to put it into words, what would it be?
The essence is the fast pace disappears. There's this smoothing rhythm that replaces it. This rhythm comes naturally with no added stress. The amazing greenery and mountain terrain of the island wash away doubts about the essence of living. It's a place where people can renew themselves and come back to life. And that's what it is.
You know, what let me tell you what I'm hearing out of what you're saying. That it's there's another word that has to be applied, and I've never been there. I'm looking at it through your eyes.
Yes.
The word's timeless.
Timeless,
yeah.
And they have a saying there that if Christopher Columbus was still alive, this would be the only island he would still recognize.
Well, okay, there you go. What it did, it stayed the same. It wasn't touched by anything.
Exactly.
Yeah. Are you going to end up living there in time?
Yes, I am. That is my goal. I am working on that right now. I've picked out my village, and I already have my two-bedroom cottage so I can write. And I spend my summers there, so I am going there in July, and I'll actually be speaking at their annual Nature Island Literary Festival, which is this wonderful three-day festival they put on to highlight different Caribbean writers and people who focus on the culture of the Caribbean.
Now, by the way, are you still doing the radio show?
Actually, I am assisting someone right now with another program in Dominica. I took the time off to go around and promote my book, and I've been doing, actually I did a conference this past weekend at a women's empowerment conference. So I've been focusing more on getting the word out and branding the island.
Okay, and by the way, very interesting catch-22 that you're in. One is you want everybody to know the beauty. The other thing is you don't want everybody to go
exactly.
there because if they do...
you are so right, Michael. You're such an intelligent man. Well, it's all about the audiences that I go to, and I really speak to people who are eco travelers, people who are looking for green destinations. And a great website to check out is actually called planeta.com. And on planeta.com, it has a lot of eco-friendly destinations where people who want to tread softly, who want to be conscious of their carbon footprint. But that's who I speak to, because the average person is not attracted by nature. The average person is not attracted by, you know, a river and drinking from a river. You know, it's like Bahamba, you know. So it's a specific genre of people that I speak to in order to help the island economically attract the right kind of people to it.
I spent 20-some-odd years in the interior of Alaska. And I was brought up in Los Angeles, and I got to a point in my life. Now I'm not there. I've been gone for almost 5 years now, but I got to a point in my life where I don't want to live next to anybody. I don't want a house 5 feet away from me. And there are people who love that, and that's the way their lifestyle is. But the other side of that, there are people who don't. And it's that open space that allow it to be you to become part of it. It's very hard to come in and become part of a city that's so massive, and there's so many different definitions of how to live, and the cultures are this and that and whatever. But if you get to a place like you're talking about, then it's big enough where you can spread out, but it's small enough where most of the people are going to be on the same page.
Exactly. And actually, every time I go, people call me by my name. And people remember you, and in my book, actually, one of the stories is I decided to take a hike to this far village because we have the most amazing view of the western part of the island. And I just go on my own. I don't have a transport. I just take a little walk way at the top. I take a little nap under a Chinese tree. And now I'm coming back down, and I'm thirsty. There's no stores along the way. And I see a young man. And I asked him, do you have anything to drink? He says, I don't have a refrigerator, but I have fresh spring water in my well, and you are more than welcome. And he brought me a cup, and I said, that'll work for me. And so I drank like 3 glasses, and then I hear my stomach say, you know, Olivia, I'm hungry. And so then I asked my friend, I said, do you have anything to eat? He says, yeah, I'm cooking some pumpkin rice and chicken. I said, I'll hang out. And so I end up hanging out, and then two other people end up coming over, and we end up having this nice conversation. We had this meal. They sent me on my way. And I'm just, I mean, you just don't get those kind of stories in America.
And what it is, it's a reflection of what I remember when I was brought up in Los Angeles. In those days, it was a different world than it is now. I've used the example time and again that, you know, in those days, and we're talking about in the 50s is when I actually grew up, junior high school, my formative years. It was those places where you could walk down the street at night, 12 o'clock at night, and you wouldn't worry about somebody pulling over and hurting you. And what I'm hearing you say, one of the main attractions, the draw, there's a tremendous amount of safety there also.
A lot of safety.
Yeah.
I mean, I have people in a lot of villages. I could come by their home, and they could be in their garden, and they would leave the door open. You just slide the door, and there may be food in the refrigerator. You just help yourself.
Yeah. I remember the old days.
It's kind of like what the U.S. was about maybe 40 years ago.
Yeah, I remember leaving that. Nobody ever locked their house or their cars. Everything was left open all the time. Absolutely. Olivia, we're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you at?
Yes, you can find me at poeticisland.com. And I actually have some of my stories there spoken by my voice. And I also have an audio book coming, too, that will be available on Amazon.com. So they can go to Amazon.com, type in Poetic Island, or go to PoeticIsland.com. All of the information is readily available, and they can get in contact with me at Olivia@PoeticIsland.com if they want, you know, a special opinions or stories about Dominique or places to stay.
Wonderful. Hey, Olivia Williams, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, all of the best, and I'll see you on Poetic Island one of these days.
You got it. I'll be the tall blonde with the dreadlocks. It's me.
Okay. All right. All of the best. Bye-bye.
Good night.
And a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and nevermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love that I can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Julie Balk with us is the author of Stop Peeing on Your Shoes, Avoiding the Seven Mistakes That Screw Up Your Job Search. She regularly appears on WCIU-TV in Chicago and on the Fox TV affiliate in Cincinnati, has her own radio show, and she's coached thousands of clients from CEOs and professional athletes to regular Janes and Joes. Julie, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to be here.
Now I know why my shoes look like that. Now, by the way, did I pronounce your last name right?
It's Balky. Balky.
Balky. Okay.
Close.
I will never get it wrong again. I got it. Okay. Now, let's talk about what we're dealing with in job search. You know, today's world is so completely different than it was 30, 40 years ago, 20 years ago, 10 years ago. And what we did looking for a job search then and what we do now is a completely different thing. And I think the biggest problem that we run into, years ago, there might have been 10 or 15 people you were up against for a job. You could be up against 1,000 today. So what is it? How do we move through this maze of catches and roadblocks to get to the job we want?
Well, first of all, there's a couple reasons for that. First of all, obviously, is the market. Anytime you've got a market where there's more people looking than people being looked for, you've got an issue. But technology has also been the big driver behind that change. If you think about it, you know, in the past, if you saw an ad in the paper, you had to go through the process of typing out a cover letter and, you know, putting your resume in a nice envelope and going to the mailbox. And, you know, you really had to think hard about applying. And now it's literally, it can be as easy as sitting in your bunny slippers and just hitting point and click. And
sure.
So, you know, it's sort of like the good news and the bad news. The good news is technology brings all this opportunity right to you, but the bad news is it brings it to everybody else too. And so that drives a lot of the competition for the jobs as well.
Yeah, there's another thing to take into consideration. There's some tremendously educated kids out there. They learn XYZ in school, but when they get out onto the street, when they get their diploma, it's not like what got taught in school. There's a whole new world out there, and for a lot of them, it's very scary, and they're not sure what steps that they can take. So I really believe when we're dealing with, you know, going out into the world, going out into the job search, there should be some classes that prep them for that, because just to get thrown out there can be really tough.
It is, and you're right. In fact, you've hit on one of my pet peeves. And that is, you know, we spend all this money to send our kids to college. I've got one in college right now. And they're learning all this great stuff. And really, they should be starting to think about what they're going to do after school. You know, probably by the end of their freshman year, they need to start having those thoughts. Well, you've got these placement offices, college placement offices, and some of them do a good job, but most of them don't, unfortunately, because what they do is they create this environment where they're bringing employers to campus to interview you. And that never happens again. That's not real world. And so the lucky few that land a job through the on-campus interviewing, that's great. But what about everybody else? And so they come home, and they're moving back in, and their parents are like, okay, fly, little bird. And they're not ready, because the bottom line is no one ever taught us how to find a job. which is why I wrote my book, because I thought, oh my gosh, if I can just stop people from making these common sense mistakes, it will drastically increase their chances of being the one who gets the job. And
by the way,
once again, technology's to blame, because the kids coming out of school now, literally, I kid you not, I hear it time and time again, think it's okay to text during an interview.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the biggest problem there, bringing that up, is right along the lines of where I was going to go with this. There's a brand new culture out there for those kids. They weren't brought up the way you were. They weren't brought up the way I was. And for the most part, a lot of them haven't been taught consequence. There's this element of respect that it's not that they won't do it. They don't know. It's not what they don't know. They don't know. It's not what they don't know. It's what they don't know. They don't know. And I think that in and of itself is a major problem. They don't get that if you're going to go out to a place and those people are going to pay you, you do what they tell you to do because that's what you're getting paid for. And
right.
If you don't like it, leave. And the problem is that they fight this. And even in the interviews, you said it, you're going to sit there in an interview and text. It's showing a lack of respect and the inability to realize that there's consequence for your actions.
Absolutely. And maybe it means we're getting old and cranky, but I swear it's worse than it's ever been. And, you know, I have a friend who does image consulting, and there was a company that contacted her about one of their young rising stars who was in his late 20s, really great, greatly capable. And they took him on a client dinner, and it was at a very nice restaurant, and he ordered a double order of fries. And it was very embarrassing to the company because it was so inappropriate. Well, come to find out, he never learned how to eat with utensils because they were constantly in the minivan going from here to there, and he lived his whole life eating finger food. I mean, that's just unbelievable to me.
Sure. Now, and by the way, the other side of that is this. You know, in your coaching practice, when you work with people, I've always thought for the longest time that if you're going to go to court, don't go without a professional. Don't go without an attorney. If you're going to do your taxes today, don't try it. Go to a professional who knows what they're doing and the end result. And if you're going to go to a job, if you're going to go find a job today in this market and in this culture, you go to a professional that can take you by the hand and lead you through the steps that you have to know to be able to accomplish what your goals are. Otherwise, there's going to be a lot of misery out there. Can you imagine what some of these kids have to go through? They're rejected, they're rejected, they're rejected. What kind of an effect, an emotional effect that has on them? And so there's so many things to look for when you're going to find a job that most of the kids don't know. And you're right, there should be a course outlining it before they even get out.
Yeah, and you know, they just, and unfortunately, they're still 22, and to some extent, they don't want to listen either. And so you almost, it's sort of that, I don't know what I don't know, but I know that I'm smart and I have this degree, and, you know, companies should be lining up. I mean, remember, this is the generation that got a soccer trophy for finishing last.
Sure.
So they really think that, you know, that a lot of stuff should come to them, and this whole concept that you and I know of paying our dues and, you know, doing the grunt work and the stuff nobody wants to do, they're very quick to move on. And, you know, each generation makes different mistakes, you know, but there are certain ones that everybody makes. And as you said in your introduction, whether you're a CEO or a retired NFL player or, you know, someone at, you know, in a administrative position, in my 14 years of doing this, you know, I saw people make exactly the same mistakes. And it didn't matter how much money they made or how smart they were, where their degree was from, you know, it's just, and it comes from, bottom line, a lack of knowing, because like I said, there is a skill set to do this. Nobody teaches us.
I'll tell you a story, but you got to promise me that you won't tell anybody.
Okay.
Okay, promise, though. Don't tell anybody.
Promise. Pinky swear.
Many years ago, and I haven't had too many jobs in my life. I just, my life is gone just a different way. I've mostly been self-employed. But in this particular case, I ran out of money, and it was a summer, and I needed to make a couple of bucks. And I looked in the newspaper, and it said, "You don't tell anybody, use car salesman," right?
Oh, no.
Oh, and I thought, no, I can't do anything like that, right? And I'm driving down the street, and there was the lot on my left. My car turned in there. It was not me. I don't take any responsibility for this at all.
It had its own GPS, right?
No, the car turned in.
Yeah.
And I walked in, I sat down. and sat down and introduced myself. And I said, I saw your ad in the paper. And he says, what do you know about cars? I said, what do I have to know about cars? I can sell anything. He said, start tomorrow. I said what he needed to hear. And we're not saying anything differently when they go in to get prepared. Do you hear it? You're telling them what to say that the prospective employer needs to hear.
So how successful were you?
Yeah. But it's about the same thing.
How'd you do on your used car career?
Yeah. And that's what it really comes down to. When it comes down to it, is you're prepping them to know what to expect. You know, there's that old adage with a lot of people today, rather unhappy than unsure. They're frightened to death to walk into an unknown situation, and they kill themselves because of that. So if they take the process that you're handing out, that you're doing, they know what's going to happen before they even walk in, which gives them tons of confidence.
You're right. I mean, I really do think when you go in for an interview or you're going to talk to someone, half the fear is, oh my gosh, what if they ask me this? What if they ask me this? What am I going to say? And so what people do is they get these big, massive books like the 10,000 interview questions you must memorize, and all that does is screw you up even more.
Sure.
And so, there's some basic stuff you can do to prep, but, people hire people. They don't hire word attachments. They don't hire pieces of paper. And until we learn, we can learn to look somebody in the eye, shake their hand, and tell our story about who we are, what we've done, what we're looking to do with confidence. Do you know? I mean, that is so common sense, but it's so rare.
Sure.
Even the old eye contact stuff, it's just rare anymore. Now, don't get me started on, inappropriate dress and showing too much skin.
And people wonder why they don't get hired.
Come on.
Now, got it loud and clear. There was one thing that I've learned a long time ago when it comes to people that are not comfortable looking in someone else's eyes. Look at their nose, and you don't have to be uncomfortable about having eye contact, and it looks like you're looking right at their eyes, and that has worked so many times.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, whatever it is. But you're right. There are people that are afraid of eye contact, and this stuff is about the way you dress. I remember years ago, if you were going to take a plane somewhere, if you were a guy, you wore a suit, a woman, you got dressed up, but they don't do that today. And these kids walk into some of the places that, and they're going to be on the front line, and they're dressed the way they're dressed, and they're unkempt, and they don't care.
I tell my son, he's just finished his freshman year in college, and I've got one this junior high school, and I say, you've got to remember who's making the hiring decisions. It's people my age, not your peers. And maybe someday when you guys are making the decisions, things will be different, and there'll be different expectations, but you have to think like I would want, what would I want to see? What would someone who's your mom's age want to see? Because at the end of the day, we're the ones making the decision. And so you have to think from the other side of the table.
Sure.
Not from where you sit.
By the way, let me give you a great way to say that, and which is true. And it's called never sell the way you buy. People buy for their reasons. They don't buy for our reasons. And
people don't
have to change. It's like, I'm listening to your personality. You got a great personality. And so never, ever be anybody but Julie. But when you're, and I'm not saying this to you just as an example.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But when you're dealing with other people, you have to step outside of yourself and think the way they think to be able to communicate and to connect.
Yep, you do. And the only way to do that is to really pay attention to the verbals and the nonverbals, and you have to stop talking long enough to ask a good open-ended question or have a conversation where you're not thinking about the next thing you're going to say, but you're actually listening, because companies and hiring managers will tell you what they want if you listen.
Sure.
So we're too busy saying, well, and then I did this, and then I did this, and oh, I forgot to tell you about these six things. And, at that point, you've really lost them. And so it really is about what you can do for the employer, but at the same time, you do want the right job. So if the employer wants these six things done and you have no interest in doing those six things, you probably need to go find someplace else to interview.
Sure.
So it is mutual, but truly, you don't just walk in and say, man, I've got to tell them about these 10 things I did. You really have to listen and figure out what they need done so you can align what you've done and who you are with their needs.
I think that was the operative word. You have to align it. You have to make it match up to what they're looking for. Also, what I believe very strongly in my heart of hearts You have to be open enough. When I say open enough, you may go in for job A, and you're talking to that person who's doing the interview, and he may say to you, you know, you're not going to work. That's not going to work for you. But I have something over here, and that could be 10 times better than what you were looking for in the first place, and you could be very comfortable and happy in that particular job. So you have to be open to opportunity, possibility. You're not being rejected. You're getting an option opened up to you, an opportunity that you might not have had before.
Yep, that's right. You know, I read a statistic one time, and I believe this, that only 25% of openings are really advertised or posted. There's really a ton of them that have not made it to be posted, will not make it to be posted, will be filled before it ever goes out to the general public. And so when you get an opportunity to go talk to a company that you're interested in, you really have to consider that this person you're talking to is the gatekeeper for all of the opportunities that company may have.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah, because there's all kinds of stuff, like you said, they're not telling you because, you know, they just, it's not been out there yet. And they decide they like you, but maybe they don't like you for that first thing you went in for. And so it's like an exploration.
And a very interesting thing that occurs also, I was was in charge of hiring for a radio station. And the way I would do it is I would put an ad in the paper, and I'd get 10, 15 people in there applying for the job. And I wouldn't interview them individually. What I'd do is I'd get the group together, and then I'd say, okay, we're all going to go into training. You know, and every day we would train, and then I said to them, if it's not going to work for you, I'm just going to ask you to come outside and just going to say thank you and you'll know. And then we eliminated it that way. But this is the one thing I would never get over. It was for the job of a advertising salesperson. And the first question out of my mouth to the group every time I did it was, what's a salesperson? And you should have heard the answers I got. Nasty, lousy people. They're going to try to steal from you. In the back of my mind, I'm thinking, what are you applying for this job for? And I really believe that, yeah, when people are going to apply for a job, know what you're walking into. I mean, if you're going to go in with an attitude that you think you're going to be a thief, you're not going to get the job.
Yeah, I used to love when people would come in for an interview and you said, do you have any questions? Yeah, what do you do here?
Yeah,
okay, you're gone. Bye-bye. You know, I mean, really? Especially today with the ability to learn more about the company than probably the person interviewing you even knows.
Yeah, and go ask the janitor. You go ask the lowest person on the totem what the company's about. And you know what? They'll tell you. That's the person that you know that knows exactly what goes on there.
That's right. The good, the bad, and the ugly.
Look for the guy with the broom. Okay, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes. The name of my company, it's www.congruity, C-O-N-G-R-U-I-T-Y, career.com. Or you can just go to Job Search Screw-Ups, because it's consistent with the title of my book. That's probably easier. JobSearchScrewUps.com takes you right to my website.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for being here. And that stuff about the used car salesman, that's between us.
Okay, but how many cars did you sell? I want to know.
Oh, I killed that first day, that first week. I made money.
Good for you.
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay. Hey, thank you so much for being
here. Okay. All right. Thanks for having me.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
The curtain's falling, the music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this bit. That's all there is. There isn't any more.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling. we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.